It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farad. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy Christmas Eve to you. Today, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite interviews from 2014. Coming up later in the program, we'll hear the story of a fashion photographer turned advocate for people with genetic differences and how he's working to change society's definition of beauty.
First, 2 years ago, Kevin Miyazaki set off on a trip around Lake Michigan to find out who the people were that lived, worked, and played on the Great Lake.
Armed with a portable photo booth, he photographed a wide range of people, from residents and scientists to dock workers and surfers, but also asked them to share their thoughts about Lake Michigan. What did the lake mean to them? Why did they care about it?
The results of his trip are chronicled in his new book, Perimeter, A Contemporary Portrait of Lake Michigan, and he joined us back in October to talk about it. I began our conversation by asking him why he wanted to tell the stories of those who call the lake home.
Well, the project was originally a commission by the Hagerty Museum of Art, which is at Marquette University in Milwaukee. And the Hagerty came to me and asked me to do a project that addresses the Great Lakes and freshwater. They wanted to participate in this ongoing discussion that's happening here in Milwaukee and in the region about freshwater and the importance of freshwater research. And so left it pretty open-ended. They said it should address the Great Lakes somehow, and it would be a photographic exhibition at the museum in 2013. And so I had been making these series of portraits for a while, people against a really simple black backdrop. And what that does is it really sort of isolates the individual, sort of celebrates the individual. Then when the photographs are exhibited in a group, it has this really kind of powerful aspect of community. So in thinking about the Great Lakes, I actually thought I wanted to make pictures of people and make a series of these portraits using a portable photo booth. And so it led to a 13-day drive around the lake in the summer of 2012, in which I photographed nearly 300 people for the project.
What were those days like when you were driving along Lake Michigan? How did you pick your route and meet people?
They were long days. I decided to stay off of the interstate highway, so I drove the entire way, just always trying to find the lake. I went counterclockwise, so I basically made this kind of beautiful big left-hand turn around Lake Michigan. But I just kept looking for the water. It was also a bit of an investigation of access, trying to see where I could find the water and what prevented me from finding the water in some cases, industry and sort of wealthier areas where it wasn't as accessible. But I just kept looking for the water, and the people I found, I would stop and photograph, sometimes just one person. Sometimes I would set up for several hours and wait for people to come by me.
And how did you approach these people who were living and working and playing near the lake?
I just asked people if I could take their picture. I had some examples. I had photographed some people before I left Milwaukee. And so I had some example pictures, and I had a statement and on a little postcard. So I just gave people the postcard and asked if they'd sit for me. It really only took a few minutes with each subject, so it wasn't sort of a big time commitment for them. And overwhelmingly, people said yes. There were only very few people out of the hundreds that I approached that actually said no.
Now, you are from Milwaukee. You live in close proximity to Lake Michigan. What is your connection with the lake?
Yeah, I grew up in Wauwatosa, so in the suburbs, really close to Lake Michigan physically. But I think my lifelong relationship with the lake has been maybe similar to most people that grew up here, where it's not a daily occurrence for me to see Lake Michigan. I don't think about it all the time, but I realize its importance. It's a compass for me. I think anyone who lives in proximity of the water like this, it sort of is a navigational, geographical compass for us. I know which direction the lake is. If I'm looking out the studio window here in Milwaukee right now, I know which direction the lake is, or if I'm driving on one of the highways or something. So it's always been sort of a grounding element for me, but I don't know that before this project I looked at it that closely, to be honest with you.
Now, when you talked to these people and took their photographs, you have got a what their connection to the lake is and what they think is, you know, important for the lake going forward. And it's interesting about the themes that emerge. There's a lot of commonality there. And one is that people seem really captivated by the changing face of Lake Michigan. And they describe it as having all these different moods, almost like a person.
It does. You know, the idea for the project was really a portrait project, but I knew I would photograph the lake as I went. Again, it's sort of this record and this investigation of access. So whenever I found the water, I would make simple pictures of the lake. And in the book, the lake pictures are in chronological order of the trip. But I knew it would be interesting because the colors and the face of the lake, as you said, would change. But I actually didn't realize how much that would be evident. And so when I was through with the trip and I had these pictures of the lake itself, hundreds of them, I realized that the complexity of the colors and the light and the water was just pretty amazing. And so those pictures actually became part of the exhibition at the Hagerty as well.
Well, let's dive into some of the stories that you got to hear about people's connection with the lake. There is a Native American leader named Frank Etowagishik who talked about his connection. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, Frank was terrific. I met him via email before my trip. In research for the trip, I was reaching out to people and trying to find subjects that I could connect with along the way. And Frank and I struck up a friendship via email, and I met him in Harbor Springs, Michigan. And I photographed him down near the water in a little tiny park in Harbor Springs, this kind of beautiful little town. And we were talking about the history of the water and his connection to the lake and his family. And then all of a sudden, sort of out of the blue, Frank began singing the Native American water song for me in this little tiny park with people walking by. And he had quite a beautiful, booming voice. And it was this really, it was a really special moment in the trip. It was about halfway. I was kind of exhausted. And it was this really kind of enlightening, very calming occurrence that happened to me. And it was terrific.
What did he say about what was precious to him about Lake Michigan?
You know, he talked about the complexity of the water, but its connections to both his ancestors and his descendants. I actually have a quote by Frank that I could read if you like.
Sure.
Frank says, so I asked the subjects, by the way, their thoughts about the lake. I really didn't have time when I was photographing people to take down notes necessarily. The process was pretty quick with each subject. But I gathered their information, and I asked them to email me thoughts about the lake. So the quotes that I gathered were really after the fact, which I think also made for, it gave people time to actually think and compose their thoughts more. But this is what Frank said in part. Its power is centered during calm and storm. Its long reach is both to my ancestors and my descendants. It's been terrifying and comforting all at the same time. Its beauty mystifies and inspires every time I come upon it. And I think, you know, a lot of people that wrote about the lake talk about this aspect of how the water sort of centers them, and it's this grounding, calming effect. And Frank described, I think, both.
Right. People talked about it as almost a therapist.
Yeah, absolutely. There's actually subjects called the Point Swimmers, this group of women in Chicago that swim most mornings when the weather permits on the lake in Hyde Park in Chicago. And one of the women called the lake her therapist. Absolutely.
Another theme that emerged throughout all of these conversations you had and these pictures, this process, was the theme of conservation of Lake Michigan. How did people talk about their worries for the future of the lake?
You know, I photographed a fair amount of people from the environmental community, particularly in the Traverse City area of Michigan. You know, I think I was telling somebody recently, after this trip, I mean, I spent a lot of time on the lake and looking at the lake and talking to people. I don't know that I'm a better expert on the lake from before my trip, and I don't know that I know deeply all the environmental concerns that address the lake, but I met all these people that care so deeply about it and that are working towards it. I think most of the people I met were very hopeful about it. I didn't photograph that many people in a large industry. But I photographed more sort of grassroots environmental people who had positive and sort of energetic ideas about the future.
Were people thinking about the next generation and wanting the lake as it is today, or maybe even in a better state, to be passed on to their children, their grandchildren, the next generations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very diverse group of people that I photographed, and the end of the book actually is a pairing of two portraits, and one is a woman who is 81 that I photographed, who was a volunteer in Gulliver, Michigan at the lighthouse. And then the last picture, the portrait in the book, is a young boy named Davis Chang, an Asian American boy who I photographed in a park in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. And to me, that was sort of a representation of this generation passing, right? The woman, Naomi, from the Lighthouse had volunteered there for many years. And it was something that was very close to her. And this young boy, Davis, who was, you know, just having a fun day with his family in the park, to me that represented the handoff, maybe, or the changing in the generations and so much faces the lake, as we know, in the future.
That's photographer Kevin Miyazaki talking about his experience traveling around Lake Michigan and photographing the people who call the lake home. We'll get to the second half of that conversation in just a moment. First, we take a look at some of the latest headlines from WPR News. We continue our exploration of the lake with Milwaukee-based photographer Kevin Miyazaki. His latest book is Perimeter, a Contemporary Portrait of Lake Michigan. And Kevin, there was another person that you spoke with, a young woman who had spent a lot of time alone on Lake Michigan, and her name was Jen Gibbons. Can you tell us about her?
Yeah, Jen is this amazing woman who rowed a boat by herself around Lake Michigan the same summer that I was actually on my trip as well. She just recently biked the entire perimeter also of the lake. But she's this really interesting Chicago-based woman who has founded an organization called Row Recovery on Water. And it's for breast cancer survivors with the idea that the training and the physical exercise is really great in recovery. But she made a solo journey around the lake in one of these sort of large rowboats that you see that they cross the Atlantic on there. Sort of a capsule where you can sleep inside the boat and whatnot. So she was on her own sort of perimeter trip and was posting a lot to social media as a way for her fundraisers and to raise money for the cause. The sad part of the story is that when she was in the Upper Peninsula area at night sleeping on her boat, she was attacked. And she recovered from that and continued her trip. So it was this pretty amazing story. She's a really, really incredibly kind of inspirational and strong woman. And so we had been in contact before the trip, but we actually photographed her after she made the complete journey around the lake.
And what did she say about her connection after all that she had been through and experienced?
Yeah, I mean, she's somebody who grew up near the water and you know, it was one of these experiences where she worked so hard. It was like this all-encompassing physical trip to row the waters by herself. And I think it was a powerful experience for her. I don't have her quote in front of me, but I can find it if we
That's okay. We can also go ahead and take a couple of the people who want to talk to you right now. Laura is joining us right now from Grand Marsh. Hey, Laura.
Hi. I just wanted to say one thing. I grew up around Lake Michigan, but my family, we would picnic on the parks and Grand Park in South Milwaukee and everything like that. But I never really saw Lake Michigan until one day when it was below zero and I was in my office on top of one of the office buildings in Milwaukee. And it was below zero weather, and I just couldn't believe it. It was like a fairyland. The lake just exuded this vapor, the cloud. It was like as if I was flying above the clouds, and I couldn't take my eyes off of it. And so I had never seen Lake Michigan like that in 25 years, and it was just marvelous. If nobody's ever seen the lake like that in the middle of winter, they've never really seen the lake.
Wow. Well, thank you, Laura, for sharing that. She says it's like a fairyland. And again, another one of these moods of the lake that you might be lucky enough to catch.
Absolutely. I just gave a talk in Sheboygan, and one of the people asked if I would do the same trip in the winter, which I think would be really beautiful. It would be, I'd probably find a lot less people, but would be a beautiful way to look at the water.
Well, thanks for that call. And you can join us with your favorite Lake Michigan story, your most iconic moment of connecting with that great lake at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And we go next to Tom joining us from Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. I believe I might have a photo in that book. Hi, Kevin.
Oh, hi, Tom. Is this Tom Castle?
Yeah, sure is.
How are you?
Good. I was just calling in to say the first time I grew up in Chicago, and it was a place that no one ever told us while we were growing up that Chicago had 200 or 300 tall ships. coming in every day during the 1870s and 1880s as a part of my history I never understood. And then I went sailing on the lake one time, and basically you turn the key to the engine off and the wind just takes you across the lake, and it was just a magical feeling. It never goes away. It's always an amazing thing. And the thing about a lot of people don't understand about the lakes is they don't just go out to see it. I was doing library programs in Chicago. I went to 41 libraries, and we were doing shows for kids out of the Chicago Maritime Festival. And they basically, between 10 and 80% of all the kids who came to those libraries had never seen Lake Michigan, even though they lived in Chicago.
That's interesting. Why do you think that is?
I think people just get themselves isolated into their own little neighborhoods and their own little worlds, and they are a little afraid sometimes to come out and go exploring. And for me, it was always the opposite. I want to go out and, you know, see more and travel more. But it was a trend that was across all socioeconomic bends and races and neighborhoods, and it really didn't matter. There was a significant part of the population of kids from anywhere from 4 years old to 14 years old who had never seen the lake.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Tom, and sharing some of those insights there. And he had some experience on tall ships. And you speak with other people in the book alongside Tom who did connect with the lake through those tall ship experiences, including the Dennis Sullivan, I think, out of Port Washington.
Absolutely. I met Tom and a group of crew members when the Dennis Sullivan and the Madeline, which is based in Traverse City, Michigan, were both docked in Port Washington. Tom's a great musician and a captain, so he kind of has these unique roles. But I met and photographed a good group of crew members from both of the boats, and many of those pictures are in the book.
Well, thank you to Tom. And we're going to go next to Laura joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I wanted to talk briefly about a memory that I hold in my heart, and I'm hoping that sometime soon I can go back again to the bluffs of the state of Michigan, just across from the Manitou Islands. And I used to sit in the trees on the bluff watching the storms evolve over Lake Michigan, and the drama and the rain and the height and the wonderful, like, almost fear that you felt as it approached you closer and closer as it mounted up, and then it would drift into this valley below us, and we would watch it pour itself out. It still is just really a delight. It's at a camp that used to be called Camp Innisfree, and I think now it's a Christian Science camp, but it's just a really great place. And so to this day, I go down to Lake Michigan whenever stress gets really big, and I sit on one of the wonderful benches that they provided and just watch the waves roll in. And it's a definite beautiful place to meditate and relax and come back to being in step with yourself. So I think Michigan is really a healing and exciting place.
Laura, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Laura's not alone in talking about, well, first of all, the healing of Lake Michigan, but also the joy of watching storms over the lake. Were you lucky enough, Kevin, to see a storm?
I did. I saw some, and the pictures in the book sort of reflect this diversity of the water scenes that I saw. But I was mostly lucky to not see too many storms. I had 13 days of photographing, and I just had one day of rain. So I was pretty lucky that it didn't hamper my picture making very much.
Well, thanks a lot to Laura for the call. And let's go next to Bill in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Bill.
I was just saying that I grew up in Racine, Wisconsin, right across the street from Lake Michigan. And, you know, I don't live there now, but I make it a point every time I get to that area to go to the same place that I was, you know, that I grew up in, and sit on the beach down there. And that's when I know I'm home. And it was a wonderful place to grow up, even though the shoreline down there has changed dramatically, but it was just a wonderful, wonderful place to grow up, and many fond memories there, friends and things. So that's about it.
Okay, thank you, Bill. And Bill, talking about the lake as being home, did you hear that from other people?
I did. You know, I photographed people that actually have the good fortune to live right on the lake. And then I photographed people that had come to this area from other places and were, I think, you know, the people that haven't seen the Great Lakes before, it's always a shock to them how large and how beautiful they are. One of the subjects, Zilke Kohl, who I photographed, was German, and she said when her parents were visiting and first saw Lake Michigan, they said, "This isn't a lake, this is an inland sea." So I think the drama maybe is lost on us sometimes if we take it for granted, but for people from other places too, seeing it for the first time, it can be pretty powerful.
And Kevin, as we wrap up here, now that you've done this project, do you think you'll see the lake with different eyes?
I do. I'm hoping to see more of it. Again, kind of promoting this book, I'm doing talks, and so I'm actually on the lake more than I have been in a while. I'll be in Traverse City in a couple weeks again, which I'm looking forward to. I do. I have more of an appreciation for it just by the sort of human connection and the people that I met that love the water so much and care about it. I think it made an impact on me, certainly.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kevin Miyazaki. His new book is called Perimeter, A Contemporary Portrait of Lake Michigan. If you've got a lake story to share or just want to tell us why Lake Michigan or another great lake is special to you, head over to the Central Time Facebook page and let us know.
Coming up after the news, we take a look at the Positive Exposure Project, which looks to empower those living with disabilities or genetic differences and in the process challenge society's traditional notions of beauty. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Hope you're having a great Christmas Eve, and thanks for spending part of your afternoon with us. We're listening back to some of our favorite interviews from recent months. We already heard a great conversation with Kevin Miyazaki about the people who live, work, and play on Lake Michigan and the deep connection they have to the lake.
Now, fashion photographer Rick Guidotti was photographing what were considered the world's most attractive people when an incident completely changed his way of looking at beauty.
With camera in hand, he's been working for the past 15 years to change commonly held attitudes toward the way we look and to raise awareness of the social and psychological experiences of people with genetic, physical, and cognitive differences.
Rick joined us for an interview back in July. He's an award-winning fashion photographer, and he's the founder and director of Positive Exposure, an arts, education, and advocacy organization that works with individuals who live with genetic and other conditions. I started our conversation by asking him about that moment that forever changed his life and who he wanted to point his camera at.
It was actually after a big casting, actually, seeing lots of models for a certain shoot that I was about to do, and I was leaving my studio, which is here in New York City, and walking down Park Avenue, I spotted a young woman waiting for the bus at the corner at Park and 20th Street, and she didn't have pigmentation in her hair, her skin, or her eyes. She had a genetic condition called albinism, or the common term was albino that I knew at that point. And she was so beautiful, and yet I realized that she had never been included in that beauty standard. She was so gorgeous. But when I went to look through medical textbooks to get any information I could about this genetic condition, to see images of this gorgeous kid and her friends with the same condition, I only found really horrible, stark medical type photographs of kids up against walls in doctor's offices with those black bars across their eyes, looking like diseases, looking like medical diagnoses. They were not people. I didn't see one photograph of this gorgeous kid, or there were just all these scary images of despair.
And this started you thinking, I gather, about what we mean by beauty when we think about it, when we look at it.
Sure. Well, prior to that, I was, you know, as a fashion photographer, you know, working here in New York and living in Paris and working in Milan, and just always being told who was beautiful, you know, and I was constantly told who the model of the moment was, and that would change each season, and, you know, and I, as a fashion photographer, I would follow all that direction, but, you know, as an artist, though, I didn't see beauty just on covers of magazines. I saw beauty everywhere, so seeing this girl was so exciting, to see beauty outside of the industry standards of the, or the parameters of the beauty standard.
So you decided to find new subjects for photographs.
Yes.
What did you want to accomplish?
Well, I wanted to see beauty outside of the parameters of the beauty standard. I wanted the beauty industry to see beauty not existing just on the covers of those magazines, to see beauty in someone with albinism to see beauty in diversity, to see beauty in human difference. And so when I went to research and to find people to photograph, I contacted an organization which was called NOAA, the National Organization for Albinism and Hypopigmentation. It's a support group for people living with this condition and their families. And I called them saying, hey, you know, I'm a fashion photographer. Let's show the world the beauty of albinism. This is going to be amazing. This is going to be so much fun. And at first they told me to go away. They were, you know, but made it very clear to me about their fear of exploitation.
Oh, yeah,
and every
yeah.
time a magazine article came out about a person with albinism, it was always about a victim, always negative, sensational, exploitative. And I couldn't agree more because that's all I could find was all this negative, this negative imagery in medical and encyclopedias and everywhere that I looked, I would only find those negative images. So at first they said no, but I said, well, let's kind of form a non-traditional partnership, a fashion photographer, a genetic support group, and together we can create something really magnificent in seeing the beauty in albinism, the beauty in human diversity, and that's how we partnered.
As a photographer, how did you approach this in a way saying, okay, I don't want to be clinical, like the medical textbooks you mentioned. I don't want to be exploitative, like the media coverage I've seen. How do you do that? How do you walk that line?
Well, you know, as a fashion photographer and or as an artist, my whole interest, my whole focus has always been on beauty and creating an opportunity to see beauty to create an environment where beauty can really shine and beauty exists in an incredible, almost tangible way. So from photographing Cindy Crawford to photographing the first person with albinism, nothing changed. I was exactly the same photographer. It was allowing that moment, that environment to kind of accept and celebrate that beauty. And so the first person that I photographed walked into my studio completely hunched over, head down, no eye contact, because of the teasing and the abuse, because of her difference, which caught me completely off guard because I was so excited to photograph albinism and to show the world the beauty in albinism. And in walks this beautiful girl who had zero self-esteem because of the abuse she experienced every single day. So that changed so many things for me right then and there. And I thought, oh, man, how am I going to photograph this kid? She's so vulnerable. But just the day before, I had photographed a Revlon shoot with Cindy Crawford on the same set in my studio. And I thought, you know, out of respect for this gorgeous kid, I'm going to photograph her like I did yesterday with Cindy or any other model. The fan went on, the music went on, and I picked up a mirror and I just held it up to her. And I said, Christina, look at yourself. You're magnificent. And she saw it. And her hands went on her hips, her head went in the air, and this smile came across her face that lit up all of New York City. It was amazing. And that's how this really started, to really not only to see beauty, but it created a slogan or a motto that everything that we do here at Positive Exposure and that I live by is that change how you see how you change. It just creates all these opportunities for people to see themselves, to see that reflection of all of us, and to see what is reflected back at us, all those great parts, and to celebrate that and to see beauty in that.
How do we recalibrate our mind to change our definition of beauty, to see it in people we usually wouldn't see it in, maybe in ourselves, if we're one of your subjects here?
Well, see, so often when you see somebody walking down the street that has a physical difference or has some sort of a difference and they're walking toward you, you either, as the public, as anybody on the street, they're not having any information about that difference, either you stare or you look away. Well, that looking away is actually even more painful at times than the actual stares for an individual living with a difference. So what I do through photography and using the arts is to create opportunities for the public to steady their gaze long enough to see beauty in that difference. And then once you see that, then you see around that to what we share, which is humanity. And it's creating these opportunities to kind of change the way that you see beauty. Change how you see how you change. You see that once you see this beauty in difference, you're overwhelmed by it, and you stay enlightened, and you start seeing beauty in other places. And this is through positive exposure, but this is also part of a huge human movement. No one wants to be seen as a disease or diagnosis. Everyone wants to be seen as a human being. And what I do as a former fashion photographer, but as an artist, to really show the beauty in that diversity.
You started with people with the condition of albinism.
Yes,
you didn't
right.
stop there, though. Where did you go next?
Well, The first images were in Life magazine several years ago, and it was a really great honor. It was a cover story. It was fantastic. And I started traveling around the world photographing people with this condition, but I also received an award, the Art of Reporting Award, from an organization called the Genetic Alliance. And the Genetic Alliance is a coalition of all the genetic support groups worldwide, and they're based in D.C. It's an amazing organization. It's providing support for the actual genetic support groups themselves and family support groups themselves. And this award was just wonderful. It was really great. It was my first big accolade from this program or project. And the director at the time said to me, I'm looking at these beautiful photographs of people with albinism from around the world. But, there's a universal message here. This is a message about celebrating all differences. Would you come to some of our family conferences and meet some of our gorgeous kids that don't have albinism but have other genetic conditions, that they, too, can celebrate their difference and have their families see the beauty in their gorgeous kids. So I went to my first conference, which was in San Antonio, which is for kids and adults living with a chromosome 18 anomaly, when you have an anomaly on your 18th chromosome. But not knowing what that was, I ran back to those medical textbooks and found horrible images of kids with cleft palates and kids with feeding tubes and trachs and kids with mobility issues. And they were horrible images. Again, I'm thinking, albinism was so easy, but this is going to be tough. But I committed, and I went, and I walked into this auditorium where all these kids and young adults were being entertained. And I opened the door, and I was surrounded. I had these horrible images burned in my head, by the way. But I walked into this room and was instantly surrounded by kids screaming with laughter. They were kids. First, if there were those giggles in those photographs, there were kids with clefts and palates and kids with trachs and feeding tubes and mobility issues. But first and foremost, they were huge. They were kids, and they were amazing. And I just fell in love with them all, and I started going. I go back to this conference constantly. But it was actually after arriving back to New York City after that experience at the Chromosome 18 conference, I was approached by the National Human Genome Research Institute, the National Institute of Health, to create an exhibition commemorating the People's Genome Celebration that was going to premiere at the Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. And I just, that was to show albinism worldwide, to show diversity within the heterogeneity within albinism or that diagnosis, and to show albinism worldwide in Fiji and Africa and Asia and Malaysia. And I said, this is great, but, I just came back from this amazing conference in San Antonio, this Chromosome 18 Registry and Research Society, where I met these beautiful kids, very stark contrast to the images in medical textbooks. These kids, look at these photographs. I said, let's invite other genetic support groups to participate in this exhibition, and sure enough, everybody wanted to be part of it. So then I started working we created that exhibition that launched, and then continued to work with all these great organizations. And now I find myself, this former fashion photographer, doing grand rounds in hospitals and speaking to medical students at medical schools around the world, and creating exhibitions and as the public exhibitions that really kind of create opportunities for the public to see beauty in difference, to not see a disease, not see a diagnosis, but a human being. And that's also the same in medical school. We have so many programs like the FRAME Project, which is Faces Redefining the Art of Medical Education, creating opportunities for the individuals themselves to explain the basic characteristics of their particular condition to healthcare providers in training. PEARLS Project, Kids Positive Exposures Ambassadors, Real Life Stories, kids blogging about their lives and their experiences, sharing and networking their everyday experiences, not just talking about their difference, but starting this dialogue, this conversation every day. Every day is an opportunity to talk about diversity, to really talk about and have new understandings each day about what diversity really does and truly means.
We're talking to photographer Rick Guidotti with the Positive Exposure Campaign. We'll have the second half of that conversation in just a moment after a look at the headlines. We're talking about changing our idea of what beauty is. We've got a former fashion photographer, Rick Guidotti. He's now actively working to highlight the psychological, the societal experiences of people living with genetic anomalies and trying to photograph them as humans, not diseases, not people who are different. Before we go to the phones, Rick, I want to ask, you're there maybe with a family and a kid. You've done these pictures. They're looking at the pictures, maybe for the first time seeing pictures outside of that clinical setting you were talking about earlier. What kind of reactions have you heard from the families, the kids?
It's extraordinary. It happens every time. It's having a mom have her child seen publicly the way she sees him. not the way everybody else sees him, but the way that she sees him. And it's so celebratory. It's so powerful. It's so inspiring and empowering to really see beauty in that difference and allow a family or an individual to look at their reflection and see what that reflection has and is holding. And it's something that's good and something that's beautiful. Different, maybe, and that's okay.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got April on the line in New Glarus. April, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious and, like, who defines normal and who defines beautiful? And, you know, why is this okay in our society that, you know, these beautiful skinny actresses are, you know, hairless and no facial hair and super thin. And, you know, I definitely have facial hair and people, I just wear it. And same thing with my armpits and my legs. And why are we so scared of like this thing that is part of us? When did this start becoming normal? So just something I think about often in kids, I get a lot of reaction from kids, you know, they stare at me and they're like, oh, that woman has, you know, hair on her lip and on her chin. But I know I'm beautiful and I have lots of people that love me and
gorgeous.
Think I'm brave and beautiful too. So
April, thanks for the call. Rick, your thoughts?
My thoughts on that is, you know, first of all, I think why that size one model on the cover of all these magazines is actually spent hours and hours in hair and makeup and then retouched for 3 or 4 days where that person doesn't really even look like that photograph. It's an industry that's selling product. It's an industry, it's it's a powerful industry that's selling product and that dream. And somehow we believe that that is the dream. And it's about, Tom, now I believe that we all think for ourselves and creating exhibitions through like positive exposure, but also listening to other April just now and listening to the people that are empowered with not, you know, bucking that system and saying, you know, I don't really want to fit into those the parameters of that beauty standard. I'm going to create my own, and that's what this is about. It's about being able to accept difference and see beauty in that, and not that kind of dictated beauty that we find constantly shoved at us on every coffee table, every magazine stand.
Thanks for the call, April. We'll go to Sandy now in Rhinelander. Sandy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. There are many members of my family that have piebaldism, which sure. is partial albinoism.
Sure.
And so, you know, our hair, like the forelock of our hair is snow white. And then the rest of our hair, you know, it could be blonde or brown or black. And then, you know, there are parts of our skin that have no pigments. So those patches are completely white. They never tan or they're always just white. And so especially in the summer when the other parts of the skin tan, it's very noticeable.
Sure. Comes even more contrast, sure.
Yeah. And, you know, as a child in particular, it was very difficult because kids are mean. You get teased
sure,
a lot.
Sure.
And then there was always, you know, people would say, what happened to you? And it's like, nothing happened to me. I just don't have pigment in parts of my
And Sandy,
skin.
Now head held high?
Yeah, as an adult, you know, my mom in particular, even though it comes from my dad's side, my mom was really supportive and reaffirming that there is nothing else wrong with you. You can walk, you can run, you can, you know, you're fine and you're just as good as everyone else. And so as an adult, especially, I guess, in the era where everybody dyes their hair and people, you know, found it to be very striking and, you know, lovely.
Sandy, I want to jump in because we're just about out of time and I want to give Rick a chance to respond. Do you hope more, you know, moms like Sandy's are getting this message and communicating that to their kids, whatever the condition we're talking about?
Absolutely, without question. And the idea is that to create the tools that are needed for advocacy, for self-advocacy, for the parent themselves to help that child see beauty in their difference, but also to create other opportunities for the individual who is reacting negatively to someone who has a difference. Give them also the tools that they need, the tools to also see beyond what they're just told. Oh, that's different. I have to look away. That's awful. It's too different. I am not supposed to accept that. I'm supposed to only accept this. And so we have to create opportunities and lots of tools that we can place in the hands of our individuals living with difference, but also to our public, of the broader public as well, to give them opportunities to accept the diversity, to accept and embrace diversity, to create a more inclusive society where all differences are celebrated.
You know, Rick, this just popped into my head. Is the next step getting the people you're taking pictures of, getting cameras in their hands, taking pictures, selfies, and pictures of each other?
Oh, this that happens, and that's always happening. We're always promoting that and promoting, especially with we have Facebook, and it's about, again, creating opportunities to see that people can actually see and be more comfortable with someone living with a difference. So, yes, absolutely, putting cameras in people's hands, taking more photographs, people feeling empowered to say, not hiding in the shadows, but standing up and be on the table, out in public, head held high, hair blowing in the wind, proud of your differences, absolutely proud of your differences.
Is this making an impact? Are you seeing a change in the people you talk to?
Constantly. Constantly. And not only have I seen the impact in individuals themselves, but in families, in communities, in schools, in healthcare practices. It goes across the board.
Amazing. Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh,
hope we can
honor.
Talk to you again sometime.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
That was Rick Guidotti, an award-winning former fashion photographer and the founder of Positive Exposure. That's an arts, education, and advocacy organization that works with individuals who live with genetic differences. He joined us for that interview back in July.
Central Time, we'll hear about the People of Rural Wisconsin Project, which aims to give a voice to the state's rural residents. We'll hear some of their stories about why they chose to make a life for themselves in the country and try to answer some pretty big questions about the relationship between place and identity.
As we gather our families around the dinner table for the holidays, some less polite family members might opt to whip out their phones, their iPads, ignoring everybody around them. We'll hear from a guest who says it's time for a new set of etiquette rules for the digital age. And he says it's okay to call people out who step out of line.
A mathematician makes the case that a little bit of mathematical thinking can go a long way and can be instrumental in our understanding of the world around us.
And maybe you're getting a little tired of all the Christmas music that's been playing just about everywhere. We've got the cure for you, bass. We'll find out why our brains are hardwired to love that low rumbling noise, and we'll dig into some of the greatest, most rocking bass lines of all time.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.